Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
The time is 6 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's time for Labor Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, Portland. This is Labor Radio. I am your host, Michael Cathcart. My co-host, Nick Bubb, is out of the country right now, so I will be doing this one solo tonight. I'd like to start by just giving a shout-out to the folks who are making their way back from Central Oregon. Looking at the map on my phone right now, it looks like there's still some pretty heavy traffic out there. So if you are listening in your car, sit back and we will take care of you for the next half an hour here. In a few minutes, I have a guest joining me, and we will be discussing some pertinent labor topics. But for the moment, I just wanted to get into a few things. First, just a little bit about the eclipse today. If you happen to see that, it was a pretty amazing thing. I was watching it here in Portland on the Tillicum Crossing. And although we didn't get the full coverage, it was about 99.6% coverage here, I believe. It was still an incredible moment. This is the first time in my life that I'd seen a solar eclipse like that. And it was pretty incredible to watch over the West Hills as a sort of a gray mass moved in. It looked like nothing I'd ever seen. It wasn't just like evening time. It wasn't twilight. It was like a different type of night sky almost. So that was a pretty emotional moment. I was up there with maybe about 100 other people on the bridge. And there were a number of people who were either, you know, sitting there just soaking it in, or it, you know, brought them to tears. A lot of people hugging random strangers and just sharing, you know, food and drink with each other. It was a pretty incredible moment, and I'd imagine that there were maybe millions of people around this country that had that same moment or shared a moment like that all across the country on the path of the eclipse. So this was a pretty incredible day. So I hope that if you're listening, you were able to watch it, or at least, you know, if not in its entirety, at least get a glimpse of such an incredible nature event. I've been seeing on different news sites the past few days that there was an estimation that the eclipse, and this was, you know, this is headline news, but the eclipse was going to cost something like employers $700 million in lost productivity. Because all the workers were, you know, everyone, the whole country came to a stop to watch it. And I think that's, I mean, it's kind of outrageous that is a headline at all, that that's something that anyone's concerned with. But it's pretty funny, and it's kind of telling, I think, about the state of our collective consciousness or our culture right now, that when, you know, this is a once in a lifetime or maybe twice in a lifetime experience, and an unbelievable nature event, and yet the focus for at least, you know, I saw it in Time Magazine and Newsweek and a few other publications, the focus for them was not on the natural beauty of it, but rather on how it was going to affect the economy and how much money employers were going to lose. And it's, you know, it sort of makes me think that it's funny, you know, as much as we humans and mankind can try and control nature, the reality is that nature actually controls us. And nature was basically telling us, hey, you know, we don't really care about capitalism. We eclipse that, if you will. So, Yeah, it was just it was a funny headline, and frankly, you know, it comes from a place like I think the law firm that actually did the estimation on the $700 million. It may not have been an exact number, but they're the folks who also estimate the loss in productivity from March Madness, from folks, you know, at work watching March Madness. But it was just a funny article, and I thought it was a little bit absurd that was what the headline was, and not just the natural beauty. So that was just a little aside. I had to share that with folks listening to Labor Radio. But I have joining me in the studio right now, and we got some headphones for you there, Miles. My guest tonight is Miles Clegg. If you want to give us a shout out to that microphone right there.
Hi, everybody. I'm Miles. Happy to be here. I'm glad Mike invited me to participate. Hopefully we can have some insightful conversations today.
Yeah, I'm glad you were able to make it. Hopefully traffic wasn't too bad out there for
No,
you.
It was really smooth, actually. It was smooth sailing. I was surprised.
Awesome. Yeah, it was sort of surprising. It's one of those things I noticed that, you know, there was such a warning, or, you know, so many layers of warning about how bad the traffic was, that it seems like everyone kind of actually heeded that and either left town early a few days ago, or just sheltered in place and stayed home today, because the city, it felt like a Sunday, despite the fact that it was a Monday morning.
Yeah, it was really smooth. I think everybody just took the day off.
Yeah, exactly. It's just an extra weekend day.
Yeah.
So, Miles, this is, I think, your first time on our show, so welcome. Thank you for coming in. And if you wouldn't mind, maybe just tell us a little bit about yourself, you know, as little or as much as you feel like going into depth about that, and then we'll jump right into a few headlines that I'd like to talk about here.
Sure. A little of my background, I guess, as it relates to to the topic today. I've worked in several different fields. I currently work for FedEx Express, which is, I'm sure most of the listeners out there are going to know what that is.
Probably.
And before that, I worked for Southwest Airlines. So I have some experience working now in both as a union employee and now currently working without a union. As far as the companies go, they're very similar. They've both been around since the 70s. Large corporations, probably Fortune 1 billion companies.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at their books, they have a lot of similarities. So I think we could probably touch on some interesting topics about how the differences are for workers that are covered employees and workers that aren't.
Right.
I probably have some insight to share there. I've been in Portland since 2008. I moved here. I transferred here in 2008, and I bought a little home in 2010. So I definitely put some roots down. I love Portland. Plan on staying here, retiring here. You know, that's kind of the nutshell right there.
Cool.
Quick breakdown.
Well, that's great. Yeah, thank you for sharing. And just for folks out there who may not be aware, so you worked for Southwest Airlines and then FedEx Express, and Southwest was the unionized employer, and FedEx is not, if I'm correct.
That's correct, yeah.
Interesting. So we're going to get into that in just a second. But one thing that I kind of wanted to circle back around, and I'd love to get your take on this as well, but this is the first time for me on the air since the pretty horrific events of a couple weekends ago in Charlottesville, the big white supremacist riot that happened there. And I know that this is not a hot take, and there's been a lot of people talking about this, and likely it's not a unique position from me, but I had to get it off my chest. I had to share this on the air. It strikes me that people are shocked, you know, still at this point, 8 months into the Trump presidency, people are shocked by his lack of response, or his you know, endorsement of white supremacy, or whatever you consider what he said was, the horrible, ridiculous, ignorant things that he said. People were shocked by that, shocked that he wasn't able to be more eloquent in his rebuttal of what they did, and that it sort of triggered a red line for a number of people. And as much as I appreciate the overall outrage at something as completely outrageous as what he, you know, his endorsement of actual Nazis marching and in fact killing someone in this country, it just seems a little too little too late for the folks who, you know, if you're someone who is condemning him and saying this is the final straw, I mean, how is this the final straw and not when he openly admitted to being a sexual assaulter, bragged about it, or not when he, you know, when he claimed in his first speech as a presidential candidate that all Mexicans are rapists and murderers, you know? How are those, how is this suddenly the red line? And for the folks out there, whether they be Republican elected officials or folks within the Republican donor base who are now saying, okay, well, you know, either privately or publicly trying to distance themselves or condemning him. I mean, it is far past the point for you to redeem yourself. If you've been supporting him to this point, then I think that despite the fact that you may not have liked what he said, it's too little too late. So just had to get that off my chest, but we're going to move on pretty quickly, unless you have anything to add to that general topic.
I completely agree. I just, I'm not sure, you know, you listen to the polls and maybe you listen to mainstream news and they have their statistics and their polling. And I guess after what happened, the most recent incident with some of the rhetoric that Mr. Trump has put out, it may be that he's lost some support, but you know, I think the people that never supported him are still, you know, it's still the same people. I'm not sure that there's a new group of people who have now decided that this is a bad man and we don't want to have anything to do with him.
Right.
I'm not sure though. You know, you can't, and you listen to the news, you listen to the polling. I'm not sure how much trust I can put in that anymore, especially after what took place in this recent election. So
yeah
it's hard to really say, you know, if there's a new group of people who may have been supporters who are now finally pulling themselves away, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, his poll numbers are down, but not enough for basically endorsing Nazism in America. So, you know, it will likely, no matter what he does at this point, it seems pretty clear that the people who support him are going to support him because either they agree with everything he does and says, or at this point they are unwilling to admit that they were wrong and they're just going to, you know, bury their head in the sand and keep plowing forward with their support of him. But just something that it just occurred to me that I always thought was kind of funny, or I now think it's kind of funny, is that you just imagine the type of person who might be, you know, saying, oh, well, there's good people on both sides. There's good people on the white supremacist side. It just strikes me that that's probably the same type of person who, if they encounter someone from like France or the UK, or if they travel in Europe, they would probably be going around being like, you're welcome. We saved you in World War II. And then, you know, from the Nazis is the unsaid part. And then in this country, they're actually essentially endorsing the right of Nazis to not only exist, but to march and to threaten people. So it just seems like there's a complete cognitive dissonance there. But anyways, we're going to move on because there's enough people out there talking about Trump, and the less attention we can give to him, probably the better.
Probably.
Yeah.
I think that might be true.
Yeah. And so we're going to move on to something actually pretty positive that's taking place here in Oregon. And we've discussed it a little bit in the lead up to it in a few of our past shows, but it is now officially law in Oregon. The Fair Work Week Act or bill was signed into law by Kate Brown earlier this month. And it's a pretty incredible piece of legislation. And in fact, it's actually, it's groundbreaking because Oregon is now the first state. There are a few other cities like New York, San Francisco, and Seattle that have passed similar laws, but we are the first actual full state to require from employers that they provide fair scheduling for their employees. And what that means is, basically, if you are a service worker, so it applies specifically to people in retail positions, hospitality positions, and food service workers. And the caveat is it's in companies with over 500 employees, but that's still covers a large swath of the working population in this state. But if you are one of those workers, the employer is now required to give you your schedule in writing at least 1 week in advance of the beginning of that schedule. And then part of that is that they cannot schedule you for shifts within 10 hours of each other. So you need at least 10 hours off. And if they do, they have to pay you extra. So, I mean, that's a pretty huge bit of coverage. It goes into effect in July 2018. And then a couple years later in July 2020, it will bump up and require the employer to give you your schedule in writing 2 weeks in advance. So it's a pretty incredible step. And it's sort of the first, in my view, it's the first step on the way to some sort of service workers' bill of rights, you know, that would incorporate fair scheduling and things like that, as well as many other things like fair payment and other elements. But this is going to cover 1 in 6 workers in Oregon is what was estimated. And in fact, 1 in 6 workers in Oregon currently receive less than 24 hours notice for their next shift, which, you know, like there's a number of positions where that is maybe reasonable if you're some sort of doctor or if you are on call as maybe an emergency technician of some sort, like that would make sense. But for someone who is working at, you know, some sort of big box store or in some restaurant, that seems completely unreasonable. And so this is a great step forward. And I guess I'd just like to discuss what this might mean for workers in Oregon, if you have any ideas on that. And then we can kind of take it into what other kinds of abuses there are towards workers that might need to be covered in this.
I looked at this. I just recently looked at this. You shared with me.
Yeah.
And I think it's great. You know, this is what's interesting to me is this really isn't anything new.
Right.
You know, if you look at most labor contracts, I can't say that I've looked at a lot, but I've looked at the ones that I've worked under, and this is pretty common stuff. You know, it's pretty, you know, you're required, the employer's required to provide you with your work schedule, whether it be a week, 2 weeks, oftentimes it's, you know, it's for a whole month. You know, if you're going to be adjusting employees' shifts and start times by 30, 45 minutes, an hour, with no, you know, the night before, it's always been something that is, you know, you should have to compensate for. One, you know, it's a terrible inconvenience. I mean, you know, for someone who might be raising kids and having to arrange childcare, you know, you just don't have the luxury of, you know, telling whoever you might have helping you that the night before that you need to be at work 45 minutes earlier, and you know, how are you going to arrange for your childcare?
Right.
Or if you ride the bus, you know, your commute could already be an hour or 2 hours. You know, it can be extremely taxing on working Americans. So this is, to me, this is basic stuff. It's unfortunate that we've reached the point where we have to rely on lawmakers to give us basic rights as workers.
Right.
You know, stuff that we should be able to negotiate with our employers as a work group ourselves, and I'm not sure why that has become so difficult.
Yeah, it's shocking that it's like a groundbreaking piece of legislation that you should know what your schedule is so you can plan your life at least 1 week in advance. I mean, I would argue that 2 weeks minimum is a reasonable time frame, and that's obviously what we're going to get to in about 4 years. But yeah, it's shocking that this is now, I mean, we're the first state to do this, and there's only a few cities in the country that require this from workers or from employers. But yeah, it definitely seems like it is, it's going to benefit a lot of workers. I mean, I know that there's a lot of companies, particularly, you know, places like McDonald's and a lot of the fast food employers who they put schedules out there, but then they adjust them based on demand, you know, based on what their customer rate is. And sometimes, you know, there a lot of the articles that were where they interviewed workers in leading up to the actual passing of this legislation, they talked to workers who, you know, would be scheduled for a shift at 10 a.m. They would show up, and as they're walking from the bus to the restaurant or whatever, they get a call or they get an email from their boss saying, oh, we don't need you to come in today, or we need you to come in 2 hours late. And that person may have commuted an hour or longer on the bus. They may have paid for that. They may have found childcare and set it all up for a certain time frame to then spend money and time to get there to then not earn money. That's completely unacceptable, but it is the reality that a lot of workers currently exist in. And I know that you and I and most of our listeners are aware of how disgusting that is. But I think that the general climate in this country, or at least the collective consciousness, doesn't seem to have an understanding of the labor history of where we come from, and why that this is actually something that we should have had put in place a long time ago. And so I think that, you know, obviously service workers and the new blue collar workers in this country, because most, you know, factory work and things like that are going away in favor of restaurant and hospitality and those types of work. But it's time, and there are, you know, there are good efforts out there, but it's time to really focus on collective bargaining, on organizing workers to demand things like this and more from every employer in every city and every state.
Right, and it really does come down to that. And it's unfortunate that, you know, when workers do, when workers are taken advantage of, that they don't have any way to speak out. Their fear of losing their job and their income and their next meal outweighs, obviously, you know, the dignity that you might need to have to stand up for yourself in these kinds of things. And the employers know that, and they've taken they take full advantage of that. And it would be nice to know that outside of legislation and government stepping in and kind of being the silent hand that, that guides these employers to do the right thing, or maybe not so silent at this point.
Right.
It would be nice to think that that workers could actually still get together and discuss these things amongst each other and organize and force employers to make these kind of basic human rights to the workers readily available without having to, you know, worry about losing your job or being blacklisted or, you know, having even worse working conditions, you know, for fear of retaliation. So yeah, all of that stuff I think is really important to me, and it's just unfortunate that we're at a place now where it's these basic things are so hard to get.
Right.
I mean, it seems like we've gone backwards.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at, there's a majority of states in this country right now that are have on the books some sort of right to work legislation. Right to work, again, we've talked about it a number of times in the show, but it basically allows workers in previously unionized workplaces to receive the benefits of a union without paying dues into them, which is essentially a union killing legislation passed by the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, funded by the Koch brothers and their network. And so, yeah, the majority of workers in this country operate in an environment where unions are not only not that present, but they're actually under attack. There is also a right to work bill sitting in Congress right now. It's probably on the back burner, considering there's a lot of other things that they're trying to get done, this particular Congress and Senate. But yeah, we have absolutely gone backwards since, you know, roughly about the 1970s in terms of workers' power and the benefits and the ability to demand better, you know, increases in benefits and wages. And so it is really time to try and turn that ship around a little bit. And with the momentum going towards the 15 Now movement, or the Fight for 15, that's definitely a good step in the right direction. This kind of piece of legislation is a step in the right direction. And it's interesting to me that this was actually passed in Oregon. At least it had some bipartisan support. It was not just Democrats, which, you know, says something about the state of politics in Oregon.
It's going to be interesting to see how this will be enforced. It does seem kind of, I mean, I haven't read it completely. I'm sure it's detailed. I get what they're trying to do here. This is basic stuff. I mean, in fact, I've seen similar things in my own contracts that look just like this. You know, the 10-hour rest rule is pretty common. Obviously, you know, usually you'll look at something, you know, like you said, there's some types of jobs, emergency responders, you know, possibly some public servants out there, police officers, firefighters, ambulance drivers, doctors, things like that, where you need to have people who are readily available to work. But you also need to remember that most of those people are heavily unionized. Those are still
right.
Some of the stronger public works unions and things like that.
And they're compensated.
And they have very clear language on, you know, how and when they're going to work extra hours and what the compensation will be. You get shift differentials, certain rules as to how many hours you can be adjusted or when they can change. So it's all really structured and laid out. Now, for the private sector, I suppose that could be a little bit more complex if you were a smaller business or if you had only a handful of employees. I mean, I could understand where the difficulties might fall, but generally speaking, this is pretty basic stuff. I'm surprised that it's taken this long. I'm surprised that it's this big of a problem.
Right.
That we actually had to go to lawmakers and outline what a good employer should be doing already.
Yeah, I mean, it says a lot about the state of our economic, I mean, of our economy and of the power that the employers have over employees, that it actually had to come down to a piece of legislation to say, hey, why don't you provide a fair work-life balance to your employees? Over 100 years ago, Henry Ford decided that he would pay his employees enough so that they could actually purchase one of the cars that they're building, recognizing that help him retain workers and provide happier workers, more productive workers, because they were being compensated fairly. That's a concept that has been entirely lost in the sharing economy, the contract economy that we have now. There's no sense of stewardship for your employees. It's all about the bottom line.
Yeah, and I really don't see that going away.
Yeah.
I mean, you're right. The idea of making the contract employee is just now catching fire, and it's hard to think that we could start reversing, some of the things that are taking place with that. And it's really unfortunate because it leaves you to your own devices as a worker. And I'm not sure that it really offers you that high of a standard of living when it's all said and done. I'm sure there's some people out there that can do fairly well working as a 1099 contractor. But for the most part, the average workers that are being put in that position are losing, and they're losing a lot.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and especially when you do hire them on as contract workers as opposed to, I mean, obviously not unionized workers, but even as full-time employees of your company or whatever it is, they feel even more isolated. I mean, and that's one of the things that I think is really the key to what employers have been pushing is increased isolation of workers so that they feel more helpless and less able to push back against the assault on them, despite the fact that they and all of their co-workers or their co-contracted workers or whatever it is may be experiencing or maybe under the same pressures from the employer. They, because there is no collective, organization that allows them to share those ideas or to bargain collectively, they feel completely helpless. And so they go in with some things that they may want from the employer, and the employer has the full force of their legal department or whatever it is. And, the threat of losing their job bearing down on the employee, and they maybe either don't speak up or they don't feel confident to demand things from their employer.
Yeah, and it's not like the productivity has increased tenfold and the profits for the companies have increased tenfold. So, the only person losing here is the worker.
Right. Yeah, I mean,
everyone else involved in that circle is winning off of the backs of, people out there trying to earn a living. So how do you turn the thing around? The machine, when the machine starts going, it's really hard to get it to even slow down, especially in in America, the way things are now. I mean, once the machine takes a direction, it's really hard to put the brakes on.
And it strikes me so that, this, it was required to have the politicians in this state put this in place in order to enforce it and to make employers follow these regulations. So is it the case then that in order to change the direction where we're heading nationally, it's going to require force put on by lawmakers? And if so, does that mean then that, I mean, it does. What we need is to have Democrats and progressive Democrats, or, progressive politicians in general elected, at least in the 2018 midterms, and then of course, moving on to 2020, we're going to have Democrats really actually stand up and support workers on not just, you know, give them lip service, but actually stand for pieces of legislation like this and going even farther and having a majority of the people, you know, take back Congress, take back the Senate, take back state houses and local districts, and make sure that, that there's a chorus of voices pushing for this type of thing, not only from the workers, but also from the political side of things. And, you know, that's much, much easier said than done. But
I agree. I think that's probably the best course of action, because I really don't see a resurgence of union organizing. It's just not something. I mean, I would like to see that. I don't see that in the future, and certainly not. There hasn't been anything on my radar that's telling me, oh, yeah, it looks like people now are really starting to consider, you know, organized labor again. It's just not something that gets talked about very often.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, I'm looking at the clock, and we are now about 10 seconds out from the end of our program here. Time, as always, flies very fast. So I think the final wrap-up message is that we need to get organized and to put pressure on employers and politicians to bring about better legislation for workers and to get people elected who actually support these things. And so with that, I have been Michael Cathcart, your host, and my guest was Miles Clegg. Thank you so much for listening, and get home safe.
Thanks for listening to me, guys. Thanks, Michael, for having me.
Absolutely. Good night.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Have you seen KBOO's Fuzzy Boo Van? It's a giant furry blue Muppet mobile that brings music and joy.